We're not told that kibble is the most processed food available on the market. There is no human food as processed as kibble. What that means is vegetables, meat, and fats have gone through an ultra high heat process. That heat is killing a lot of the minerals and the proteins, and then it creates the Maillard reaction, which, if you're eating a hot dog or a hamburger and you kind of char broil it, that gooey, yummy black stuff is actually a known carcinogen. That Maillard reaction is what is happening to the kibble.
Welcome to the Dr. Joy Kong podcast. This is where I have a chance to share with you some of the latest developments in the space of holistic health, longevity, and wellness. I have always honored intellectual curiosity and scientific rigor, combined with real-world practicality. My goal is that what you learn here will help you live longer and live better. Hope you enjoy the journey with me.
Hello, welcome back to the Dr. Joy Kong podcast. I'm here to enhance your health and enhance your quality of your life, your longevity. And of course, there are many aspects to our health, from our own physiology, from our psychology, from our financial well-being, and but also from all the people and things we care about, including our pets. So today is actually going to be the first time that I'm introducing a new subject, which is the health of our pets. And this is a really near and dear to my heart because I love animals and I think they're such incredible gifts to us and to the world because of that. And I know how much so many of you absolutely love animals and care about, you know, your little children at home, furry children. So I brought in a wonderful veterinarian to come here and educate us and enlighten us on how we can better the health of our pets. So I want to introduce Dr. Scarlett Magdalene. Hi, Doctor.
Hi, Scarlett. Thank you for that intro.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I'm so happy that you're here and I just can't wait to dive in, but I want to give people a little bit of background about you. So just so they understand that, you know, your journey, you are actually an award-winning regenerative veterinarian with over 15 years of experience clinically in both emergency and general veterinary medicine. And you founded the Regenerative Sanctuary in 2024, which is an innovative veterinary healing service. You combined advancement in human medicine and traditional Chinese medicine to optimize pets' health. So Dr. Scarlett's mission is to heal without causing harm and to focus on regeneration rather than just repair. She completed her Bachelor's of Science degree in and Doctorate of Veterinary Medicine in Ontario Veterinary College. She completed internship in small animal medicine and surgery from the Fifth Avenue Veterinarian Specialist in 2010. And she has been trained in traditional Chinese veterinary medicine, five elements theory, and food therapy at Qi University. She's currently training with Dr. Ava Frick at the Clinical Animal Nutrition Academy. And her experience is that she has seen countless animals with diabetes, obesity, cancer, arthritis, various skin and autoimmune conditions. And this inspired her to see what kind of affordable and regenerative solutions exist. Her goal is to help pets live pain-free, disease-free, and that's why she created the Regenerative Sanctuary. So I want to dive into a conversation with Dr. Scarlett. You know, thank you for your drive at helping animals and going into areas that are really not traditional. So in a sense that we have similar paths, you for animals, me for humans. And of course, I'm all about regenerative medicine. And it's lovely to hear that your center is called Regenerative Sanctuary. So one thing I want people probably to have an understanding of is really the state of animal health care and animal nutrition, because then nutrition is always the foundation, whether or not it's for humans or for animals. So Maybe give us an idea of where you think animal care is at this stage and the state of animal nutrition.
I feel that we're at an intersection right now of evolving our profession. Being in emergency veterinary medicine for 15 years and seeing a pattern develop with certain cases, particularly medicine cases, I felt that something was wrong. And I noticed that there was a parallel between what was happening with our pets and what was happening in human medicine, where we're not addressing nutrition, we're symptomatically treating things and not going to the root cause. And that disturbed me. Of course, for emergency situations, a traumatic event, a fracture, we definitely need modern medicine and surgical care. However, when it comes to core physiologic understanding of going back to basics, how the body works, and how do we support that body in doing what it's designed to do, which is to heal naturally, that philosophy has sort of left our way of addressing animal health. And it became a very protocol-driven, what are the symptoms? What are the differentials? And going to a certain number of tests, and then you kind of hit a stopgap. And that stopgap wasn't adequate for me. And so I feel that we are at a crossroads because pet owners are frustrated. They're frustrated with the state of their animals who have obesity, chronic conditions that require continuous medication, such as diabetes and allergies and skin issues. And they're really not getting better. They're just having to continue medications and pay these bills. And pet owners are driving the conversation and really doing their research now and coming to veterinarians with alternative ideas, and especially when it comes to food. And I feel that nutrition needs to be a pillar in our education and our foundational knowledge. And learning about kibble and the different prescription diets is really not appropriate health advice. And that's what we were taught. And so I feel that there is a shift happening, and I'm very optimistic about it, only because I know what the solutions are. But at the moment, I do believe that there is somewhat of a crisis going on, and it has to do with this revolving door of going to the vet and continuing to pay the bills and continuing to have these conditions. I think veterinarians are also wanting always to do the best they can, and they're also curious and wanting more, just like I was.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the state of the problem is with pet nutrition right now? Like, what's the major problem?
If you were to just look at how food is prepared on your plate versus a bag of kibble, and you would go to the basic understanding of how those two meals were prepared, you would understand the problem. So we're not told that kibble is the most processed food available on the market. There is no human food as processed as kibble. So what that means is the vegetables, meat, and fats have gone through an ultra high heat process. That heat is killing a lot of the minerals and the proteins, and then it goes through an extrusion process. So we have heat as a main problem. So heat creates the Maillard reaction, which, if you're eating a hot dog or a hamburger and you kind of charbroil it, that gooey, yummy black stuff is actually a known carcinogen. And so that Maillard reaction is what is happening to the kibble. And so we have these compounds that are formed from the processing. And from a Chinese medicine perspective, we look at the thermodynamics of food. And so that heat doesn't just disappear. It goes into the body and it creates the inflammatory cascade that we see with so many of the disease conditions. And also, in order for kibble to be crunchy and stay in that form in the bag for the amount of years that it says it can stay, there must be a high proportion of carbohydrates. No dog should have a diet higher than 25% carbohydrates. The average kibble is anywhere from 45 to 60% carbohydrates. Mm.
The same thing for cats?
So cats are strictly carnivores. Dogs are omnivores. So cats need 90% protein. They are much higher rate metabolizers, and they must have protein in their diet in order to function, or they'll start breaking down their own protein in their bodies in order to get that protein that they need. And so feeding a cat kibble is the worst thing a pet owner could do to set them up for a chronic disease situation. So looking at moisture, these kibbles are about 8 to 10% moisture because the heat has eliminated most of the moisture. You'd be wanting around 60 to 70% moisture in a diet. So we've killed the bioavailability of the nutrients. If you look at a label of a kibble, you'll notice a lot of the vitamins and minerals are added back in. Mm-hmm. That is because they were killed in the processing, but those aren't bioavailable. They're just meeting the minimum standards of AFCO. AFCO is the body that helps us have nutritional guidelines for animals. But what most people don't realize is that those are minimum requirements. Mm-hmm. They're not optimal requirements. And so...
And they're not bioavailable for the most part.
Yes. And so this is why I'm such a proponent for home-cooked meals, which would be the best. It's obviously difficult because it's time-consuming, but you either spend your money on food or you spend it at the vet. And I want our profession to be here to support animals and living optimal, long, pain-free lives and be there to support them in their regenerative process rather than setting them up for a situation that ends up like we currently have, because we aren't taught nutrition. And I'm talking about real nutrition, whole food nutrition, which goes back to the time of Hippocrates, food is thy medicine. And so if we look at that, we look at kibble, your plate of home-cooked meal, and everything I just said, does that kibble really look like medicine to you?
So the kibble, basically, it's, I mean, what's the percentage of pet owners that actually that's all they do, that they just...
I don't have that statistic, but I would say it's probably 80%.
Wow.
And I think it's going down because pet owners intuitively are realizing that something's wrong. And there are so many fantastic, fresh, raw pet food companies out there that are providing good information and good options. Mm. And the proof is in the pudding. You can see the animal before and after eating real food versus kibble. Mm. And once you've crossed that line, there's no going back.
You mean they love the real food?
Oh, yeah, because their animals are, first of all, they're losing weight. They're not pooping several times a day with large moist poops. Poops should be firm and like where you can grab it and it doesn't break. And not voluminous where they're going several times a day. That's all the carbs.
What about canned food? Is that much better?
Yeah. Canned food would definitely be a step up from kibble for sure, because you're addressing the moisture content, requirements, and it hasn't gone through that ultra high heat extrusion process, but it's still processed to some degree and it's stored in aluminum. And I have not seen a patient yet that doesn't have elevated aluminum levels in their hair.
Pardon me? If there's a high level of the metal aluminum, what's going to happen?
So it's a neurotoxin, and it also displaces body's normal ability to handle its own mineral load. And so you can address aluminum not only by trying to eliminate it, but I can tell you it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. The chemtrails have aluminum in them, so now we have free aluminum particles in the environment. And so it's just the current state of our world. And so rather than going on like a giant aluminum elimination hunt, which is very difficult, it's imperative to be having your animal on the best diet and supplements possible. And that customization is what allows for the body to arm itself with the tools to deal with these heavy metals. And so there is no diet that has the adequate minerals your animal needs or you need, because the energy consumption of every animal is unique. And therefore, the minerals are the building blocks to the cells. They're carrying the charges for the electrical conduction to occur. And so having the appropriate minerals for that time of state of that animal is the customization that's needed for it to deal with the situation. And so you can actually have the body kick aluminum out if it has appropriate calcium, magnesium, zinc, manganese. The liver will deal with it. And so I see a lot of animals with high aluminum, but if their iron isn't high, it tells me they're able to deal with the aluminum. If the iron's high, you know you've reached detox capacity and now you need to really support the body.
What about adding something like fulvic acid back into food, right? So fulvic acid is, you know, full of minerals, and they add it back in agriculture for plants to grow better. And now we can give it to humans, brings about all these minerals into the body and into the cell, you know, intracellular space. Not a one single molecule, but a group of essential nutrients. The fulvic acid is what I use. I mean, I use for my patients, but I do sometimes give it to my pets, thinking that if these help the plants to grow better, because that's a natural breakdown product from plant matter that should be in the soil. So what I use is actually extracted from the deep earth layer that's from the crustacean period. So it has that, is very, and is a confluence of fresh water and sea waters is rich in minerals. So that's what I add back. But it definitely, you know, I'm not talking about single nutrient. That's very limited. But I want to give them a group of essential molecules that's you know, good for life, period. So that's the fulvic acid.
Yeah, I have to look it up because it hasn't been introduced.
Maybe it would be a good thing.
It's always good things to add in
because consider. Humans do much better. I have a podcast on it, you know, on the fulvic acid. You know, it could be a good equalizer, because this doctor, a naturopathic doctor, what he found was when he used to carry like over 200 supplements in his clinic. And then some people get better, some people don't. But when he introduced the fulvic acid, it's like an equalizer. Now everybody's getting better because you're replenishing a lot of the essential signals. So it brings up the ability of the body for everybody. And now he has much less supplements. So because he's giving something more foundational. It's a brownish substance that should be in our soil, but our soil is so depleted that what they found is that in agriculture, that's where they first started, when they put back that fulvic acid, then plants grow so much better. And of course, as humans, we eat those plants and expecting that we're going to get the nutrients, which we were not for a long time, you know, in recent history.
Well, yeah.
Till this day, probably. Yeah, it's such a confusing area, I think, for a lot of people. Exactly what do we do for our animals? There are also, you know, just different schools of thought. And I saw somebody, I think he's a vet on Instagram. He was saying that you should feed your animals once a day so that they have a chance to, I guess, break down, you know, and their digestive system to rest and break down, you know, I think he was talking about autophagy. I'm not sure, mm-hmm. but in humans, biohackers definitely were talking about eating once a day or twice a day. But I also read for animals, they were, for like cats, they need to eat, you know, more than once a day. Otherwise, it's not good for their system. So even that, you know, what is the truth?
So there is definite benefits to intermittent fasting, which most of us are aware of. And so these animals in nature are not typically eating several times a day. They're usually eating like a smaller window just because of their ability to hunt and find food and satiety and how much do they really want to hunt versus rest. And so looking at natural patterns helps to answer that question in congruence with our current lifestyle, which a cat in your house does not have anywhere near the same lifestyle as a wild outdoor cat or a feral cat. I like to suggest feeding animals, the cats and dogs, within an 8-hour window. Mm. I think with dogs, it's more possible to do one meal a day. But if they've been on like a kibble diet and they're fed morning and night, you need to give them like 2-3 months to adjust to that schedule, because it's and also thermodynamically that kibble is so high in carbs and it's a very different energetic profile than a freeze-dried raw or fresh food. And so
are they just more hungry more often?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Exactly. And the more hungry more often is from the carbs. So they're burning through them fast and they're not getting the nutrients that they need for the reasons I mentioned at the beginning. So having the more protein and the real food is going to change that behavior of the eat hungry, eat fast. So dogs, okay, so with cats, they can go into a dangerous situation if they don't eat for 5 days. And that is, it's a life-threatening emergency and they're breaking down their fat and protein and they're making a ton of acids. And so that's the reason why you don't want to put them into that high stress state of just eating once a day. But if you have them in that 8-hour window, you'll be fine. With dogs, they sometimes can develop something called bilious vomiting syndrome, where if they don't have a meal within, I would say, like 6 hours of going to sleep, and then in the morning, they can often throw up. And that's just from having like this empty stomach. And with those dogs.
Is that a problem?
I think unless you're detoxing something like a toxin or a food that is perished or contaminated, vomiting isn't the greatest on the system. You're having acid hit the esophagus, now you're dealing with ulcers, and so if there's a lot of vomiting going on, it can become a problem.
But in nature, are they always able to eat within 6 hours of going to sleep?
No. So I'm just saying for our lifestyle here at home where we can control everything and things are so controlled.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful. You know, to know that, you know, as far as how often to feed the animals. So you're saying for dogs, it's probably okay to do once a day.
And if you've trained them to get to that point.
I see. Okay. But for cats, they do tend to break down their own tissue.
If they don't have enough protein. So we have been taught to feed cats a low protein diet if they have kidney disease. And it's actually harmful because they don't change their metabolism of how they assimilate protein, whether or not they have kidney disease. They have to have protein in the diet in the same amount. And so this is like something that we've...
This is a myth that
and
the medical community is bringing disservice to the animals.
Yeah, because the vets who've tried giving high protein, which is what a normal cat would eat, to a cat with kidney disease are not seeing negative consequences. In fact, they're actually seeing positive consequences. Protein is vital for cats. There's a lot of amino acids that they can't make that dogs can. And so like taurine, carnitine, it has to come from the meat.
Those frozen foods in the frozen section, I mean, that would be a step up above the canned food.
Absolutely.
Are they that good? Or we have to be very careful with them.
So yeah, here's the two things I would arm people with when looking at labels. So one is, what are the first four ingredients? In at least one of those frozen diets, I saw corn as the third ingredient, or sweet potato, or any other carb. And I did not see any organ meats. Cats and dogs need 10% organ meats in their diet every day. So liver, heart, those are like core organs. But tripe, like variety, because the minerals and the proteins that are in those organs are not, they're super concentrated, and they're not the same as your sexy chicken thigh, which completely different profile. So look for organ meats in those frozen diets, and look at where are the carbs on the ingredient list as far as closer to the top or more at the bottom. Those would be the two things that I would be looking out for.
So ideally, first one is some kind of meat.
Yes, and not meat and meal. Because meat meal can be anything.
Oh, okay. So what's the problem with the meal?
You don't know what it is. So you could take a whole chicken and have like all different body parts put through a blender, and that's what you're getting. And so you don't know like how much is feathers versus bone versus meat. With the actual chicken, it like legally has to qualify as the meat.
So the first ingredient, meat, and then hopefully the second ingredient, some kind of organ meat.
So having like the first two be like two different kinds of meats, and then the third could be like a broccoli or a carrot or peas. But just be aware of things like lentils, sweet potato, corn, wheat, which are all okay as long as not GMO corn, because we have a whole thing with glyphosate that I could get into. Having a general sense of how high are those high starch vegetables on the list. And then your organ meats are usually like the third or fourth ingredient. And then there's just a lot of different variety of vegetables.
So even for cats, you're okay with all those vegetables as a third ingredient?
No. Looking at the percentage guaranteed analysis, which is confusing when you're looking at a frozen food, because moisture is going to occupy a lot of the percentage. And so sometimes when you see the protein, it can be like, oh, it's 10% protein. And that can seem like low. But in general, you just want to be aware of the ash and the fiber. And I can help it's a little, there's too, it's too much math for me to just tell you how to do it. But for, and I'm happy to provide this like option for people. It's just, it is two steps they have to do in order to know how much carbs are in a frozen packaged food versus a dry food. Dry food is easier to discern. But in general, like, just use your intuition, like how much of this like frozen food is meat versus vegetables for a cat.
Okay, so how much is supposed to be meat?
90%.
90%. Okay, so you need to take away the moisture account, you know, take out the moisture, and among the rest, 90% should be meat.
Yeah, so I would say 80% meat with 10% organ meats, and then 10% vegetables.
Just, you know, I just want to make sure people have a practical tip when they actually go to the store to buy it for their pets and know that they're getting a really good one for their pets.
Yeah, and if they want to cook at home, Animal Diet Formulator, ADF, is a great tool where you can subscribe for the home formulator, and you just follow it, and then it will tell you how much of what food to put your pet's food together. And I can tell you that those diets are safe for human consumption as well. Obviously not the raw ones, because we don't have the same gut as cats and dogs for eating raw food, but a home cooked meal, like, you could share it with your animal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the problem is that some of the herbs we use, I mean, I'm happy to share my food with an animal, but some of the seasonings we use are problematic, right? So supposedly, was it like a onion, garlic?
I mean, yeah. So that's another myth that was debunked when I went to Chi. So if an animal eats an entire clove of garlic or a bulb of onion, you're going to have problems. Mm-hmm. But if it's just the small amounts that we're putting to season our food, it's actually going to have the same benefits, antioxidizing, anti-inflammatory benefits as it would for us. And so it's a matter of how accustomed is your animal to these spices. Cayenne pepper is going to move the chi, is going to move the energy. But of course, it's super hot. So you just want to be mindful of how much are you using. And so this comes down to exposure. Like, ideally, cats and dogs should have 3 to 4 different diets, meats a week. It's not something we're used to doing. And it's like a very different lifestyle change. But to get to that point, you slowly have to introduce all these different foods because they may have been on a single diet this whole time. And so it's just getting them used to it. And so you could introduce these spices and foods and different vegetables as you're eating yourself, and slowly just give them like 1 teaspoon. Well,
that would be nice, because that's what they want.
Yeah, they want it for a reason. They're smart.
More about these spices. That scared me. And I thought, okay, now I have to cook something separately for them. But then that's extra, you know, time and barrier. So it's so much easier if I can just share the food.
Yeah, I mean, ginger, turmeric, these are all fantastic spices for us and our animals. The only thing they can't have is chocolate and grapes. Other than that, it's a pretty fair game.
That's for both cats and dogs?
Cats and dogs, chocolate. Cats, they don't have a grape issue. We don't really understand, like, what is it in the grape specifically that creates the kidney failure? Mm-hmm. And then Lily.
For dogs,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah, it's a wide list that you can start offering your animal.
But those are the only two things. Are there other things that we have to be
really cautious? We're taught not to give them avocado, and they can have avocado. It's a question of what have they been eating this whole time, because avocado has high fat. And if they've been on a high carb diet, their gut biome is altered to not have the specific bacteria that are needed to help break down fat. Because it's not just the lipase and the bile that's breaking down fat. It's also the bacteria in the gut. And so if the food has been like a mono type food, then they don't have the diversity in their biome to handle these new foods like avocado, for example. And so it's just a matter of, and you know, some animals are like dogs, or they'll vomit with peanut butter because it has high fat, but that's just because they're not used to that fat. And so it's a matter of introducing these foods to your animal over 1 to 2 months.
Well, that would make things a lot easier if we can share some of the food, you know, with them. That would be amazing. I did attempt to make a whole batch of a food for my cats following a recipe, but they didn't want to eat it. So that was
Yeah, it can be difficult to transition them if they've been on a canned or kibble diet, because there's also certain sprays that have been added to make that kibble attractive. And they become carb hoarders, where just like us, if we're exposed to potato chips, you can't stop eating them. It's the same thing with them. And so basically you just bring your new food next to what they're currently eating and like slowly have them get the choice, so they can like get accustomed to, oh, what is that other food there, and just be super patient.
And you said kibble, but there are these freeze-dried, you know, pellets that you can get. How good are they?
They're excellent because they're the least processed of the prepared on the shelf foods that do last quite a while. So they have had the moisture vacuumed out of them. And so a lot of the bioavailability of your proteins and your minerals are going to be there. The only thing to be mindful of, especially for a cat, is they need that moisture. So adding water to the freeze-dried raw would be a great way to address the moisture deficiency in the freeze-dried raw. And then whatever meat you're eating, lamb, chicken, fish, just give it to your cat. Give them a little bit.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you would think that they will drink enough water on their own, but sometimes they don't, just like people. We forget.
Yeah. I think as they become more in tune with a natural system of foods, their patterns will improve. This is just my intuition. I haven't like looked at any research on this, but it's just kind of what's coming through as you're talking. And so this is where like having these fun things like the water fountain to encourage them to drink is important.
What about salt? Are you concerned with the salt in human food?
Not really. Salt is going to increase their water load. It's going to increase their blood volume, their blood pressure. if there's a cardiac condition, then that's a situation to be mindful of. But I think that we've been overly cautious with salt to the point where it's causing problems. So sodium is the emergency most important mineral in our body, because your sodium potassium pump is handling every single interaction in your body every second. And so that mineral needs to be present in the body for it to function. And so I think if there isn't cardiac issues, then whatever normal or intuitive amount of salt that you would have is appropriate. And it goes off taste. Like you could, you know, taste it and see you know, is it super bland or is it super salty? And the animal will know too. Like,
do they also prefer a little bit of salt? I mean, does that make the food taste better to them?
From like a research standpoint, I don't have an answer to that, but intuitively, I would say yes.
Okay. All right. So I'm curious about you utilizing Chinese medicine. So until I met you, I didn't really know that people were using that on animals. And growing up in China, no one was talking about using Chinese medicine on animals either. So I'm just wondering how that came about and, you know, what's the history of it and how does it work exactly?
Basic fundamentals of Chinese medicine for humans is, for the most part, very easily adaptable to animals. When I say for the most part, I'm talking about five elements. So what is the constitution of that animal? Are they a fire dog? Are they a metal dog? That's the same for a human. And so there's this personality survey that you use to help decide what kind of core constitution personality is that animal. So same principles. We have yin and yang, feminine, masculine. All of those principles are the same for all beings. And so when you start to understand that the core functioning of the body, where the spleen, liver, and stomach is the middle burner for a human and an animal, you can see how logical it is for this to translate. And so the Chinese studied nature and humans for 8,000 years, and they took that knowledge and created the field of traditional Chinese medicine 2,000 years ago. As far as when it got translated to animals, I don't have the exact information for you. But what I can tell you is Dr. Xie took his knowledge from China and brought it to America in the early 1980s, and he created Qi University. And so I believe that institution's 20 years old, and I apologize, I have to literally look it up to tell you. But it's in my lifetime that this science got brought to America. So from a Western standpoint, it's relatively new. And how I got into it is I was, as I said earlier, really frustrated with where things currently stood in Western medicine, not understanding the root cause of disease, not understanding, like, why are we feeding kibble and not real food? And so I was told by a vet student colleague of mine that there is a whole institution called Qi University that teaches traditional Chinese vet medicine, and acupuncture can cure a lot of conditions. And she was showing me the before and after of her cases, particularly like back injuries, lameness. And I was like, okay, there's something here. There's an energetic system that works with the body's energetic system to heal it. And so when I went to the Qi website, the thing that really caught me, in addition to five elements theory, which is your basic, is the food therapy. And once I got the book, Traditional Chinese Veterinary Medicine Food Therapy, I was hooked. I was like, I have been craving this my whole life. And now, I mean, I'm still not an expert in it. It's takes a while, but you literally learn not just the thermodynamics of food, like lamb is the hottest meat, for example. Cucumber is cooling. But you also learn like how different foods can decrease edema, address constipation, address diarrhea. And now you're armed with natural whole food ingredients that you can recommend to the pet owner to assist in supporting that disease condition going back to homeostasis.
Yeah, that's wonderful that that through acupuncture that kind of convinced you of the energy channels being a real thing, right? So that's...
Yeah, and the only reason why I didn't study it is because the Erconia laser came into my field and I then learned about mitochondrial activation and how the laser can regenerate these organs. And so I then became fascinated with the laser and decided that I'm going to put my efforts into regenerative medicine and bring in or refer to people doing acupuncture, just because I, you know, it takes time. It's 2 years or something to learn. And maybe my next, you know, 10 years, I'll take it on. But tremendous respect for it.
For anybody that who comes to get stem cell treatment from me, we're using the laser while they're getting the stem cell infusions to, you know, to make the stem cells more viable, more active, more mobile. And then we can also attract the cells that we're infusing into the area that we really want them to be in. So it's a multi-purpose. So what have you seen with the laser on the animals, this Erkonia laser?
Miracles.
Okay.
So this is a case that just came to me last week. So it was a Rottweiler who had a chipped shoulder. So a piece of the top of the humerus was floating in the musculature. And that is like your worst situation, because you can't go cutting through the muscles looking for this little bone. And what are you going to do with a small fracture at the top of a bone surgically? Nothing. Mm. And so I had this owner rent my violet green and my red laser for a week and gave her a protocol, and the dog is completely sound now. It's been a week. Mm. And I'll be presenting this case on Monday. I have a 2-hour lecture if anyone's interested. It'd be my bonus case, because it's just so exciting to watch this dog who's like limping and sad and painful be completely like happy and sound in a week.
What do you think the laser did?
So the red is recruiting stem cells and decreasing inflammation and pain. The violet is activating complex 1 and 2 on the electron transport chain. So you have the beginning of the mitochondrial activation cascade happening. And if there's any microbials there, it's addressing them. Then the green is activating osteoblasts and having bone remodeling reformation. And so when we have all three wavelengths, we're dealing with addressing the chipped bone. We're helping the body rebuild itself through its own healing pathways by activating the stem cells and the mitochondria and decreasing pain and inflammation. I mean, I don't think you could have a better tool in your kit for a case like this than that.
Do you think the fragment was, you know, came out of the muscle then?
I think it's being absorbed by the body.
I see. Yeah. Amazing.
It'll be cool to see an x-ray in 2 months.
Mm.
Because I'm thinking that it's being drawn to where the chip is and it's creating a callus. But time will tell. But it's fascinating that so maybe the chip, the fragments of the edges got smooth from the laser, so it's not like cutting into mm-hmm. the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what the repeat x-ray shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, wonderful. I know I have to let you go. Where can people find you to get help from you for their pets?
So my website, theregenerativesanctuary.com. is a great place, and my email is drscarletvet@gmail.com. I love doing virtual consults, helping with nutrition and customizing your plan. All of my products are non-prescription. They're specific supplements, so it's really easy to work with anyone anywhere and be a addition to your healthcare team.
Amazing. Thank you so much for the work you're doing to help the animals, that your drive, you know, I know it all came from you just really caring about their well-being. You just want them to live a good life. So thank you for your heart, which drives all this knowledge that you're seeking and helping others. So yeah, so I'm sure all these animals are grateful there's a human being out there trying to look out for them.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thanks for having me. Thank you for all you do.
Oh, thank you. All right, Dr. Scarlett. So thank you again. And I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode on our pets.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Hope you enjoyed the content. And if so, please rate and follow this podcast. To learn about everything I do, including my memoir, Tiger of Beijing, you can go to www.drjoykong.com. And if you'd like to reach me, simply send in a contact form. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel, Joy Kong MD. I'll see you next time.